All right. Well, good morning. So our passage today is from Mark. It, as you heard, it consists of two stories, each of which revolve around the Sabbath. And if you look back, this is actually part of a bigger section in which there's a number of confrontations with Jesus. So 2 weeks ago, we looked at the confrontation of Jesus and the teachers of the law when there was the man who was let down into the room and Jesus forgives his sins, and there's that, they're upset about that. And then last week we looked at two stories about food. So the first one was Jesus eating with sinners and tax collectors, which they didn't appreciate. And then Jesus' disciples weren't fasting on the Sabbath. So in other words, Jesus is, I want you to see that Jesus is flaunting norms. He's flaunting tradition. He's doing in the minds of the religious leaders things that are unlawful. And these confrontations have been building since the beginning of chapter 2. And today they come to a climax. So that's kind of what you need to kind of understand before we start. Okay, so if you're following along, we're in 2:23 to 3:6. It's kind of awkwardly broken up in chapter 3, but this is all definitely, Mark wants us to hear this together. All right, one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields. And as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisee said to him, "Look what they are doing, what is unlawful on the Sabbath." So good chance it's probably summer. It's probably wheat or barley. When I was farming in Illinois, this was just about the time that wheat was drying down. You would our kind of goal was July 4th, and we grew wheat so we could have some straw for mulching. And what often I was harvesting strawberries at this time, and often I'd walk by one of our wheat fields and I'd grab a few heads of grain and I'd kind of roll it through my fingers. Some of you farmers probably know what I was doing. I was touching the kernel and I wanted to see how much moisture was in there, right? Because I wanted to see, is it time to combine this? But it also provided a little snack. I kind of enjoyed snacking on some of those wheat kernels. So this is a little bit what's happening here. These disciples, it's the Sabbath. They're walking through the field. They're grabbing a few heads of grain, and they're eating it. And the problem isn't that they're walking through their neighbor's field grabbing some grain. Like, as long as they don't use a sickle, as long as they're not technically reaping, they're fine. The problem is they're doing it on the Sabbath, which I think should sound a little strange to us. So we got... that's a bean field over there. I don't think there's any cornfields around us this year, but a few months from now, if I'm out, it's a Sunday, you drive by, this might be a little strange, but you see me out in a cornfield and I'm walking and I'm grabbing an ear of corn and I'm snacking on it. Like, what is most alarming to you about that? That I'm harvesting it on a Sunday or that I'm traipsing through our neighbor's field? Like, in our society, private property is way more sacred than the Sabbath. Private property is way more sacred than time. Time's really not super sacred to us. I think this is part of the challenge why this looks odd. And so for us to get our minds around what is sacred about time, we gotta remember what the Sabbath is. So think about other religions. Other religions tend to have sacred places. So Islam has Mecca. Hinduism has the Ganges River, and Judaism had some sacred places that had a temple. It had Jerusalem, but Judaism had something else. It had sacred time. And the Sabbath, which began on Friday and lasted till the sunset on Saturday, was sacred time. Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's one of the most well-known Jewish scholars of the 20th century, wrote that for the Jewish people, Sabbaths are our great cathedrals. I love that line. I ran up against it in our sermon series on the Sabbath. Sabbaths are great cathedrals. What he's saying is that we as Jewish people, we're not known for our building, our brick and mortar cathedrals. What we're known for is cathedrals of time. And this is important because when the Bible talks about Sabbath, it talks about entering in. So kind of imagine yourself actually entering into Sabbath, which is a little weird for us. Entering into time is not something we think of. So when you step in, if you've ever been to Europe or one of the great cathedrals in our country, you step into a place and something feels different. I mean, even if it's a little different than your stream of faith, something feels different when you step into one of those cathedrals. And for Jewish people, when you step into the Sabbath, something's different. Something is now sacred. And there's this rhythm. This rhythm is 6 days of work, and then you stop and you rest for one day. And And for us as Christians and for the Jewish people, this is woven into the fabric of the universe. Right from the beginning, God created on 6 days and rested on the seventh. Interestingly, of the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath command is the longest. Like when we think about the Ten Commandments, is the Sabbath commandment the one that first comes to your mind? Hopefully you've gotten a long teaching series on Sabbath, so maybe. But for most people, that's not what we think about. But for two practices for the Jews, that set them apart from other nations, Sabbath and circumcision. So for the Jewish people, to abandon Sabbath was to turn your back on God. And interesting, in the book of 2 Maccabees, there's actually Jews that are willing to die rather than break Sabbath. So Sabbath is a big deal. It's a big, big deal. And the Sabbath commandment was, if you read it, and it's in a couple of places in the Old Testament, it's rather straightforward. One day out of seven, the Sabbath, don't work. So set that day aside for rest and worship. But then you have to ask the question, what is work? So if Sabbath is that big of a deal, you can't just leave that up to chance. You can't. So what had happened by this time is that the religious leaders had begun to saddle the Sabbath commandment with all these regulations about what was work, what constituted work. And one of those activities was harvesting grain on the Sabbath. So it's interesting. Jesus responds, but he doesn't get into the minutia of the law. He doesn't get into the nitpickiness. He doesn't try to debate. He goes back to a story about David. In verse 25, he answered, have you never read what David, when he and his companions were hungry and in need? Have you ever read about what David and his companions were hungry? And so we missed this. This is kind of funny. So Jesus is asking the Pharisees, have you ever heard this story? Like, there's a little bit of sarcasm here, which I think, like I said, Jesus, I think, is a lot more funny than we give him credit for. And there's some humor here. It's like me, Ernest here. If you don't know Ernest wrote a whole commentary on the book of Philemon and Colossians. It'd be like, Ernest, you ever read Colossians? Ernest is like, yeah, I devoted years of my life to Colossians. So there's some sarcasm here. This is kind of funny. He continues, in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which was lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. So in this story, it's a story from 1 Samuel. David's been anointed king, but he hasn't quite ascended the throne, so he's on the run and he's hungry. And he comes to a priest, and the priest says, I don't have any ordinary bread, but I have this consecrated bread. And this would have been what would have been known as the bread of presence. So this is the bread that priests would have been able to eat only by priests. It would have been in the tabernacle. So David should not have been able to eat this. He's not a priest. Only priests are allowed to eat it. But he does in the story. And Jesus, it's not entirely clear all the connections that Jesus is trying to make, but it seems like the general point Jesus is saying is that there's going to be times when human need takes precedence over usual guidelines. So just like David in this situation, he and his companions are hungry. They were allowed to eat. My disciples are walking through this field. They're getting some grain. They're able to eat. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. So notice, Jesus isn't abolishing the Sabbath. He's not even trying to erase all the guidelines for the Sabbath. What he's saying is that these laws and these regulations, all these ways that you've tried to protect the Sabbath, you've turned this thing that's a gift into a burden.
That here.
So Sabbath was never intended to be a burden. It was a gift. It's supposed to be a day of refreshment and joy. It's like our Christian Sabbath. We worship, we rest. It should be a day of joy. But over time, that had been lost. And so Jesus isn't trying to abolish it, but he's trying to get Sabbath back to where it was intended to be as a gift. When we bought a house in Columbiana 3 years ago, I was really glad it had a yard. It was not 180 acres. We got a little bit spoiled that our kids had 180 acres to roam around in Illinois, but it was a good space. It's been a good space. So I'm thankful for it. And my hope when we move there, my hope right now is that, especially this time of year, that my kids will spend lots of time in this space. I want them to have fun. I want them to be creative. I want them to be outside. I want them to be active. Hopefully they're not listening. I want them to do like slightly risky things and me not know about it. Because I think most of us that grew up, like, that's part of being a kid, right? You do things you shouldn't do. That's my hope. That's my vision for the space. This is going to come back to haunt me one day. What it never ceases to amaze me, the creativity that my kids and just kids in general have when they have space. So I look back in my backyard, I see a bunch of white clover, and I'm like, I need to mow that. They see a place this weekend, they put on a play for us. I see a shed, a little shed in my backyard to hold tools. They, a few weeks ago, saw it as a lookout tower to stand guard against raccoons who were coming into our compost pile. I never would have thought about that. They stood guard for, I think, hours. I see a box in the garage that needs to be recycled, and they see the potential to make it into a wooden, like a carriage. And so my kids, like most kids, like you give them a little space and a few things, and the potential is limitless. But the challenge for me is that our backyard is chaotic a lot of times. So I'm trying to mow, and I'm trying to mow around fairy houses. I'm trying to replant grass where one of my sons thought it'd be a good place to dig for worms. My pile of lumber often is turned into forts. And sometimes I come out and I just start laying down the rules. I start laying down the regulations to rein in the chaos and disorder in my backyard. And to a certain degree, this is normal and helpful. But sometimes it reaches a point where the laws get so many. Is this true? Are you giving an amen to this? That I just see the joy like drain out of my kid's face. This has happened numerous times. Like at some point I have so many regulations that it's lost its fun. It's like, well, let's go inside. Let's go watch TV. They want to do the thing that I'd rather them not do. And if I'm not careful, they end up walking around on eggshells because they don't want to break one of my regulations. And something similar has happened with Sabbath over time. The Sabbath was created by God for joy and refreshment. It was created for the benefit of humans. But over time, the legalism around Sabbath had sucked a lot of the joy out of it. Regulations had made it so the people felt like they were walking on eggshells. And that's why I think when Jesus is asked this question, I think he's kind of like, whatever. Really? This day that's a gift from God, you're worried about my disciples eating some grain. You have lost the spirit of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was given to you. It's a gift. It's made for you, not the other way around. And so Jesus is trying to bring Sabbath back to its true purpose. But notice again, he doesn't abolish it. He's not legalistic like the Pharisees, but he's not anti-law. In fact, famously, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount near the beginning, I have not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. And secondly, notice how Jesus says the Sabbath was made for man. He doesn't say the Sabbath was made for Jews. He says the Sabbath was made for man. The Sabbath was made for humans everywhere. Humans are not created for endless toil. We are not created either for endless leisure. I don't know about you, but my experience in life is that the times my life has felt most out of whack is when I have constant toil, constant labor, with essentially no time off, or I don't have enough meaningful work to do. I don't know which is more miserable. I think both are kind of miserable. I think as humans, we want meaningful work to do, but we all probably, most of us in our working age have experienced, I'm working too much. I'm not stopping. So we're built in the image of a creative God. We're built in the image of a God who creates, who takes disorder and makes order out of it. And we also are created in the image of a God who rests on the seventh day. There's a rhythm to how humans thrive. So depending on how old you are, like we have a wide spectrum here, which is great. Sabbath might be a super legalistic, and your connotations in your mind are very legalistic baggage from your childhood. You're probably, if you're over 80 or 90, do we have anyone over 100? I don't think we do. We have some older people in our congregation. You remember when businesses shut down? You remember when, you know, if we were driving home and we went by the Wanger place and they were out raking hay, that was a problem, wasn't it? I mean, you might not say anything, but you'd look down on that. And in response to that, some of you are like, good riddance to the Sabbath. Good riddance to the legalism of my childhood. I'm glad I can mow my lawn and not worry about someone from my church driving by and judging me. I'm glad I can go get a cheeseburger at Hex after church and not have to cook. Good riddance to the legalism of Sabbath. But let's be honest, like most of us, my age, for sure my age and younger, like that's not our problem. Like, we're not, I'm not worried if I mow the lawn what my neighbors are going to think. We're on the other extreme. I talked about this a lot a couple years ago. We're on the extreme where Sabbath almost means nothing to us. Stores don't shut down. We keep on shopping and consuming. Activities don't stop. We keep on moving. We should stop for one day, but we don't have time to stop for one day. We can't get everything done in 6 days. And you know what? Our society is exhausted. Is exhausted. You know, pre-COVID-19, the standard response to everyone my age is, how are you doing? I'm busy. Almost like, probably didn't have to think about it. Well, of course I'm busy. So for the Jewish people, the badge of honor that marked their identity was Sabbath. That was what separated them out. For us, the badge of honor is that we don't have time. We're too important to have time. As Lily Tomlin puts it, the trouble with the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat. Man wasn't made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for man. Sabbath is a gift. It's a time of refreshment and healing. It's a time for being and not doing. It's a day that we realize we're enough today. We're enough. Like right now, none of us is working. None of us is posting on social media. None of us is emailing, I hope. And the world's fine, right? The world moves on. It's just a good reminder. The world keeps going even when we stop. And we realize our deepest identity is not in our work. It's as a child of God. It's a day for eating good food. It's a signpost that we think back to Eden and we think forward to the age to come, of the banquet to come. Sabbath was made for man. It's a gift. As I mentioned, 2 years ago, I spent 6 Sundays talking about Sabbath. And some of it, I think Sabbath is really important. A lot of that, to be honest, was for myself. I really struggle learning how to stop and rest. And over the last two years, very imperfectly, I and my family have been trying to practice Sabbath. And I've got two observations. One, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made, to be intentional about stopping and not taking a day off, but taking a Sabbath. I look forward to Mondays. Most of your Sabbath is a Sunday. Mine is a Monday. I can shut off email. I can shut off news. I drink good coffee on the Sabbath. I eat good food on the Sabbath. We can enjoy God's creation. I can just enjoy God rather than sometimes in the work I do, I'm just constantly learning about God. I need to just learn to enjoy God and not just learn about God. And two, Sabbath is hard to keep. Every Monday, I have to fight my desire to be productive, to be busy, to make that day like all the others. Strangely, Sabbath takes a huge amount of discipline and planning, but it's been such a gift. And so there's so many challenges from this pandemic. I mean, I think we know these. There's death, loss of businesses, loss of health, just loss of connection, so, so much to mourn. But one positive thing, and I noticed especially early on, when things shut down in my neighborhood, I saw all kinds of families out in the neighborhood walking. I saw more people walking as a family or biking as a family than I had in 3 years. All of a sudden, it's like my neighborhood in Columbiana just came to life. I heard so many stories about families saying, we're eating together now. Like, we don't usually do that, but we have time. We're eating together. We're playing board games together. Like, we're tired of whatever, Netflix. Let's just do a board game. So they start doing all these things that normally they don't have time for. We don't have time for. And so the stay-at-home order created space for people to actually recapture some joys that have been lost. And we don't want to stay, and we're not in a stay-at-home now, but we don't want to stay there. But we need some structure to our week to keep that rhythm in our lives. I think one of the best ways to do that is to keep a Sabbath. Like, don't have a day off. Keep a Sabbath. So first note, if you're taking notes, keep the Sabbath. Try it. I'm happy to talk to you. I've made a lot of mistakes, but on my journey, it's been such a joy. Second story. Let's keep going, because both these are about the Sabbath. We have this controversy between Jesus and the Pharisees that revolves around Sabbath, and this time it takes place in the synagogue. And now what I want you to feel is this atmosphere is highly charged. So all these confrontations that I mentioned, they're building, and it's got to the point where the Pharisees are ready to accuse Jesus. And we have at the end of the passage, if you heard it, there's this really shocking line. They walk out of the synagogue, and they begin to plot Jesus' death with the Herodians. So the fact that they walk out of synagogue and want to kill someone, kind of shocking, very shocking. What we don't get in our context is they walk out and do it with the Herodians. The Herodians were the Pharisees' enemies.
Okay.
The Herodians were pro-Rome. They were pro-Herod. They were nationalists. They were pro-Israel. They runned Rome out of there. The Herodians supported Herod, supported Rome. The Herodians were fine with Greek culture, Hellenism seeping into their lives. The Jewish people wanted nothing to do with Greek culture. They wanted to keep themselves pure from any kind of infiltration of Greek culture. So what I want you to see is these people have nothing to do. They want nothing to do with each other, except they see Jesus as a threat. They unite around the threat of Jesus, and they decide they want to kill him. So kind of as we look at this story, keep that in mind. So they're in the synagogue. Pharisees are watching Jesus closely, but they're also watching a man with a shriveled hand. They know Jesus has healed before. This wouldn't be entirely usable. But the question is, will he heal on the Sabbath? And so we're already getting kind of a picture of what's in these Pharisees' hearts. They look at someone with a shriveled hand, and they think, that's a pawn. I can use that person. At the time, the basic understanding was you could, if someone's life was in danger, you could step in and do work to save their life. But if their life wasn't in danger, you weren't supposed to do anything. And clearly, a shriveled hand, this guy's probably had this most of his life. He's not in danger of dying. Now, notice, too, that all the other healings up to this point, Mark, Jesus is interrupted. He's teaching, he's walking, he's in a house. The person comes to him, but Jesus initiates this one. Neva, will you stand up? Imagine this scene with me for a second. Are you feeling a little self-conscious, Neva? Not too bad, a little bit. This guy, he has a hand in his cloak, right? For this guy, you can feel the man's horror right now. If he had ever dreamed that his handicap would become a public spectacle, he would not have come to synagogue that day. So rather than escape notice, which is what he wants, the deformity is now on full display to everyone in the synagogue. Just hang with me another minute. Pause the sermon. Okay. So at this moment, the guy's standing up. What we expect is Jesus to heal him, but it doesn't happen. He looks at the synagogue. He looks at the Pharisees, and he says, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? I think this was a brilliant question on Jesus' part, because I think there's two levels that are going on here. One, there's a pretty straightforward question here with a pretty straightforward answer. Does God want good or evil? Does God want life or death? Sabbath is a gift to man. It's a day of refreshment and joy and healing. If there's any day for healing, it should be the Sabbath. Even the Pharisees should know how to answer that question. Of course, it's to do good. But that's not what the question they're thinking about. They're not looking at the overarching purpose of the Sabbath, which is absolutely to heal. They're thinking about the rules, which means, sorry, too bad. The rules say no healing on the Sabbath unless a life is in danger. That's the rules. And if Jesus and the Pharisees are having a theoretical debate about this, this is the right answer. Okay, can you heal this? No, in this case, you can't. But that's not what Jesus is asking. Remember, there was a real person standing up there. Okay, this isn't a hypothetical abstract debate. There's a guy standing there in the synagogue with a shriveled hand. And Jesus is saying, no, this guy standing right in front of you, this guy who has suffered who knows how much humiliation and pain from this deformity. We're talking about this guy. Is it lawful to heal this man? See, in the abstract, questions about theological orthodoxy and moral behavior are usually pretty clear. Like in my pastor's study, when I'm thinking about theological orthodoxy, it's usually pretty clear in my head sometimes. It's when there's like real situations, real people in front of you that things get much more complicated. As one commentator put, the test of all theology and morality is either passed or failed by one's response to the weakest and most defenseless members of society. The test of theology and morality is not in the abstract. That's not where we work that out. It's worked out when we actually have real people in front of us, especially the weakest and the most defenseless members of society. The Pharisees' response is silence. And it becomes very clear that at the end of the day, for the Pharisees, religion is ultimately about fulfilling laws. It's more about abstract rules than concrete face of suffering right in front of them. So I asked this question last week. The Pharisees, good guys or bad guys? They're looking worse all the time, aren't they? I was listening to a sermon by a guy named John Mark Comer this week. And he listed all these signs that you might have a bit of Pharisee in you. You ready for this? Okay. All right. I'm going to read it. I'm going to make a little bit of adaption. Number one, all right, this is like you might be a Pharisee if religion is mostly about rules. So I understand what you're saying, but the rules are the rules, right? Rules are rules. Number two. You think of yourself as the guardian of right and wrong. Like we certainly see that with the Pharisees. They're on their day, on the Sabbath, they're out like in the field watching Jesus. They are the guardians of what is right and what is wrong. Number three, you are quick to criticize and slow to compliment. Your instinctual response is to criticize rather than compliment. Number four, you see the bad in the situation, but you miss out on the good and the beauty. So, for example, you walk into a room and you've criticized five people in your mind before you've laid out a single compliment. You might be a Pharisee. You just wish people were more like you. None of us ever feel that. If everyone could just do things like me or think like me, this world would be fine. COVID-19 would go away. Whatever the problem is would go away if people would just be like me. Number six, you don't eat or drink with people that are far from God. I talked about this last week. Who's invited to your table? Is it only people like you, like us? Are we worried that like somehow we might get tainted? You might be a Pharisee. Number seven, I just got a couple more. Every new reading of the Bible is guilty until proven innocent. So, you heard a passage when you were a kid, and then somebody stands up and preaches on it differently, and you're like, that's not the way I heard it. That's wrong. What happens is that actually your tradition has more authority than the text. I never heard it that way. At that point, you're pharisaical because your tradition is more authoritative than the biblical text. And number eight, it's more about the issue than the person. It's easy to get fired up about issues. Like we as Christians, we love getting fired up about issues. I can name a lot of issues that we've gotten fired up about. The test is, do you speak that to the person right in front of you who is not an issue but is actually a person? Not because the issue doesn't matter. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying because, wow, if the person is right in front of you, that issue is really different, isn't it? So how did y'all do? How did you score? I scored like somewhat high, I'll be honest with you. Like if you had like personality types that are like perfect to be pharisaical, like my personality types would be perfect. Pharisaical heart postures are not just in the text, they're right here, aren't they? I think at least all of us at least resonated with one or two of those. And Jesus is not a fan of pharisaical heart postures. Jesus looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. Very few times do we see Jesus this emotional. Jesus is angry. He is angry at their stubborn hearts. Now, we need to do a little work here with it. We think of hearts and we think of emotions, right? In English, we say the heart is the seat of emotions. But in the Jewish understanding, the heart is the seat of the mind. So it's not that the Pharisees are being malicious, or Jesus thinks, they're just unwilling to understand. They're closed off to new possibilities. They're closed off to the new thing that Jesus is doing. And Jesus is angry. Like, this is a description of righteous indignation. But Jesus isn't just angry, he's distressed. And really, I think a better translation of Greek is grieved. That's how the NRSV translates it. Jesus was grieved at the hardness of their heart. In other words, Jesus is sad. Jesus is angry, and he is grieving in his heart about what he sees. In Ephesians, Paul says, be angry, but do not sin. Jesus reminds us here that anger is not a sin. In fact, I think we would all agree that Jesus' righteous anger was totally justified. If Jesus had not been angry about this, I think we would have been kind of frustrated with Jesus. But look at the combination. This is what I want you to notice. Look at the combination here. He's angry at the injustice, and he's grieving. He's sad in his heart. Jesus does what is so, so, so hard to do. He's angry and he's grieved. As Ben Witherington put it, anger without compassion results in censoriousness, meaning you're hypercritical. You're always fault-finding. But compassion without righteous anger results in tolerance of the very things that destroy humankind. What Witherington is saying is that you need both these things. To just have righteous anger is a problem, but to just have compassion and not righteous anger is a problem too. Like, look at Jesus. He's angry at the injustice he sees, that the refusal to see the man with the deformed hand as more important than the rules. And at the same time, he's grieving for his enemies. I don't know about you, but that's not my go-to move. My go-to move is get angry about injustice and follow that with self-righteousness. Or get angry about injustice and get angry at the people for being so dumb. That's hard. Jesus' response is anger followed by deep grief for the perpetrators of injustice. Jesus is teaching us, remember, as disciples of Jesus, we've been sent back to Galilee to watch Jesus and figure out how do we incorporate this in our life. Man, I think there's lots of space for us to incorporate this in our life. I think Jesus is brilliant. And this is why he's Jesus, because he holds this together. He teaches us, don't be afraid to stand up to injustice. And at the same time, do the hard work to still love those enemies who may not agree with you. Like, even grieve for them in your heart. That's hard to do. So that's all happening on one level. There's the guy standing up there. There's the guy with the shriveled hand. But then there's something else happening here too. The question is, Jesus asks, is which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? And this question is ripe with irony, right? Because what's happening here? It's the Sabbath. Jesus is healing. What are the thoughts going on in the Pharisees' mind? They're hatching a plan to kill him. The beginnings of an execution plan are forming in their hand. They're thinking to themselves, this guy has to die. And it's the Sabbath. Meaning, Jesus extends compassion to this man, and at the same time, this is costly compassion. This man, he leaves the synagogue with a restored hand and a new life. Jesus leaves the synagogue with a bullseye on his back. And we know where the story is headed. Most of us know where the story is headed. Jesus will, on a cross, defeat the deforming power of sin in our lives. He will defeat the paralysis of sin, and he will do it with great, great compassion and great, great cost. I kept thinking of, from Isaiah, by his wounds we are healed. By his compassion, by Jesus' compassion, the wounds inflicted on him, we are healed. And because of that, the Lord of the Sabbath invites us into the ultimate rest, into the rest of Jesus Christ.